At about a quarter to six, the Irishman led me to the spike. It was a grim, smoky, yellow cube of brick, standing in a corner of the workhouse grounds. With its rows of tiny barred windows and a high wall and iron gate separating it from the road, it looked much like a prison. Already a long queue of ragged men had formed up, waiting for the gates to open. They were of all kinds and ages, the youngest, a fresh-faced boy of 16, the oldest, a doubled-up, toothless mummy of 75. Some were hardened tramps, recognizable by their sticks and billies and dust-darkened faces. Some were factory hands, out of work. Some agricultural labourers. One, a clerk in collar and tie. Two, certainly imbeciles. Seen in the mass, lounging there, they were a disgusting sight. Nothing villainous or dangerous, but a graceless, mangy crew, nearly all ragged and palpably underfed. They were friendly, however, and asked no questions. Many offered me tobacco, cigarette ends, that is. We leaned against the wall, smoking, and the tramps began to talk about the spikes they had been in recently. It appeared from what they said that all spikes are different, each with its peculiar merits and demerits, and it is important to know these when you are on the road. An old hand will tell you the peculiarities of every spike in England, as at A, you are allowed to smoke, but there are bugs in the cells, at B, the beds are comfortable, but the porter is a bully, at C, they let you out early in the morning, but the tea is undrinkable, at D, the officials steal your money, if you have any, and so on, interminably. There are regular beaten tracks where the spikes are within a day's march of one another. I was told that the Barnet St. Albans route is the best, and they warned me to steer clear of Billericay in Chelmsford, also Ide Hill in Kent. Chelsea was said to be the most luxurious spike in England. Someone praising it said that the blankets there were more like prison than the spike. Tramps go far afield in summer, and in winter they circle as much as possible round the large towns, where it is warmer and there is more charity. But they have to keep moving, for you may not enter any one spike or any two London spikes more than once in a month, on pain of being confined for a week. Some time after six, the gates opened, and we began to file in, one at a time. In the yard was an office where an official entered in a ledger our names and trades and ages, also the places we were coming from and going to. This last is intended to keep a check on the movements of tramps. I gave my trade as painter. I had painted watercolours, who was not. The official also asked us whether we had any money, and every man said no. It is against the law to enter the spike with more than eightpence, and any sum less than this one is supposed to hand over at the gate. But as a rule, the tramps prefer to smuggle their money in, tying it tight in a piece of cloth so that it will not chink. Generally, they put it in the bag of tea and sugar that every tramp carries, or among their papers. The papers are considered sacred and are never searched. After registering at the office, we were led into the spike by an official known as the Tramp Major. His job is to supervise casuals, and he is generally a workhouse pauper, and a great bawling ruffian of a porter in a blue uniform, who treated us like cattle. The spike consisted simply of a bathroom and lavatory, and for the rest, long double rows of stone cells, perhaps 100 cells in all. It was a bare, gloomy place of stone and whitewash, unwillingly clean, with a smell which somehow I had foreseen from its appearance, a smell of soft soap, jay's fluid and latrines, a cold, discouraging, prisonish smell. The porter herded us all into the passage, and then told us to come into the bathroom, six at a time, to be searched before bathing. The search was for money and tobacco, Rompton being one of those spikes where you can smoke once you have smuggled your tobacco in, but it will be confiscated if it is found on you. The old hands had told us that the porter never searched below the knee, so before going in, we had all hidden our tobacco in the ankles of our boots. Afterwards, while undressing, we slipped it into our coats, which we were allowed to keep to serve as pillows. The scene in the bathroom was extraordinarily repulsive. 50 dirty, stark-naked men elbowing each other in a room 20 feet square, with only 2 bathtubs and 2 slimy roller towels between them all. I shall never forget the reek of dirty feet. Less than half the tramps actually bathed. I heard them saying that hot water is weakening to the system, but they all washed their faces and feet, and the horrid, greasy little clouts known as toe rags which they bind round their toes. Fresh water was only allowed for men who were having a complete bath, so many men had to bathe in water where others had washed their feet. The porter shoved us to and fro, giving the rough side of his tongue when anyone wasted time. When my turn came for the bath, I asked if I might swill out the tub, which was streaked with dirt, before using it. He answered simply, "Shut your fucking mouth and get on with your bath." That set the social tone of the place, and I did not speak again. When we had finished bathing, the porter tied our clothes in bundles and gave us workhouse shirts, grey cotton things of doubtful cleanliness, like abbreviated nightgowns. We were sent along to the cells at once, and presently the porter and the tramp major brought us supper across from the workhouse. Each man's ration was a 1/2-pound wedge of bread smeared with margarine, and a pint of bitter, sugarless cocoa in a tin billy. Sitting on the floor, we wolfed this in 5 minutes, and at about 7 o'clock, the cell doors were locked on the outside, to remain locked till 8 in the morning. Each man was allowed to sleep with his mate, the cells being intended to hold 2 men apiece. I had no mate, and was put in with another solitary man, a thin, scrubby-faced fellow with a slight squint. The cell, measured 8 feet by 5 by 8 high, was made of stone, and had a tiny barred window high up in the wall, and a spy-hole in the door, just like a cell in a prison. In it were 6 blankets, a chamber pot, a hot water pipe, and nothing else whatever. I looked round the cell with a vague feeling that there was something missing. Then, with a shock of surprise, I realized what it was, and exclaimed, "But I say, damn it, where are the beds?"
"Beds?" said the other man, surprised. "There aren't no beds. What'd you expect? This is one of them spikes where you sleeps on the floor. Christ, ain't you got used to that yet?"
It appeared that no beds was quite a normal condition in the spike. We rolled up our coats and put them against the hot water pipe, and made ourselves as comfortable as we could. It grew foully stuffy, but it was not warm enough to allow of our putting all the blankets underneath, so that we could only use one to soften the floor. We lay a foot apart, breathing into one another's face, with our naked limbs constantly touching and rolling against one another whenever we fell asleep. One fidgeted from side to side, but it did not do much good. Whichever way one turned, there would be first a dull, numb feeling, then a sharp ache as the hardness of the floor wore through the blanket. One could sleep, but not for more than 10 minutes on end. About midnight, the other man began making homosexual attempts upon me. A nasty experience in a locked, pitch-dark cell. He was a feeble creature, and I could manage him easily, but of course it was impossible to go to sleep again. For the rest of the night we stayed awake, smoking and talking. The man told me the story of his life. He was a fitter, out of work for 3 years. He said that his wife had promptly deserted him when he lost his job, and he had been so long away from women that he had almost forgotten what they were like. Homosexuality is general among tramps of long standing, he said. At 8, the porter came along the passage, unlocking the doors and shouting, "All out!" The doors opened, letting out a stale, fetid stink. At once the passage was full of squalid, grey-shirted figures, each chamber pot in hand, scrambling for the bathroom. It appeared that in the morning only 1 tub of water was allowed for the lot of us, and when I arrived 20 tramps had already washed their faces. I took 1 glance at the black scum floating on the water and went unwashed. After this we were given a breakfast identical with the previous night's supper, our clothes were returned to us, and we were ordered out into the yard to work. The work was peeling potatoes for the paupers' dinner, but it was a mere formality to keep us occupied until the doctor came to inspect us. Most of the tramps frankly idled. The doctor turned up at about 10 o'clock, and we were told to go back to our cells, strip, and wait in the passage for the inspection. Naked and shivering, we lined up in the passage. You cannot conceive what ruinous, degenerate curs we looked, standing there in the merciless morning light. A tramp's clothes are bad, but they conceal far worse things. To see him as he really is, unmitigated, you must see him naked. Flat feet, pot bellies, hollow chests, sagging muscles, every kind of physical rottenness was there. Nearly everyone was undernourished, and some clearly diseased. Two men were wearing trusses, and as for the old mummy-like creature of 75, one wondered how he could possibly make his daily march. Looking at our faces, unshaven and creased from the sleepless night, you would have thought that all of us were recovering from a week on the drink. The inspection was designed merely to detect smallpox and took no notice of our general condition. A young medical student smoking a cigarette walked rapidly along the line, glancing us up and down, and not inquiring whether any man was well or ill. When my cell companion stripped, I saw that his chest was covered with a red rash, and having spent the night a few inches away from him, I fell into a panic about smallpox. The doctor, however, examined the rash and said that it was due merely to undernourishment. After the inspection, we dressed and were sent into the yard, where the porter called our names over, gave us back any possessions we had left at the office, and distributed meal tickets. These were worth sixpence each, and were directed to coffee shops on the route we had named the night before. It was interesting to see that quite a number of the tramps could not read, and had to apply to myself and other scholards to decipher their tickets. The gates were opened, and we dispersed immediately. How sweet the air does smell, even the air of a back street in the suburbs, after the shut-in, sub-fecal stench of the spike. I had a mate now, for while we were peeling potatoes, I had made friends with an Irish tramp named Paddy Jacks, a melancholy, pale man who seemed clean and decent. He was going to Edbury's spike, and suggested that we should go together. We set out, getting there at 3 in the afternoon. It was a 12-mile walk, but we made it 14 by getting lost among the desolate North London slums. Our meal tickets were directed to a coffee shop in Ilford. When we got there, the little chit of a serving maid, having seen our tickets and grasped that we were tramps, tossed her head in contempt and for a long time would not serve us. Finally, she slapped on the table 2 large teas and 4 slices of bread and dripping, that is, 8 penny worth of food. It appeared that the shop habitually cheated the tramps of tuppence or so on each ticket. Having tickets instead of money, the tramps could not protest or go elsewhere.